I'd like now to welcome to the program Marie Friedman Marquardt. She is a scholar in residence at Emory University's Candler School of Theology in Atlanta, Georgia, and she is lead author on the new book, Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a book that attempts to really look at what's behind all the typical stereotypes around immigration that make it into the news, particularly the corporate media. Just quickly, what are some of those stereotypes that people tend to be bombarded with if they're looking at immigration just from a mainstream media point of view?
You know, there's so many, it's difficult to know where to start. I think one of the stereotypes that we really are concerned to address, it may not be the one that immediately comes to mind, but it's very important, and that is that, you know, illegal or unauthorized immigrants are these transient newcomers who just came into the United States yesterday across the U.S.-Mexico border. It just is clearly a wrong impression of who constitutes the unauthorized immigrant population. Another really important one is the claim that we often hear that immigrants are receiving more in services than they pay in taxes, and that immigrants actually are sort of a drain on our local economies. The claim that unauthorized immigrants steal jobs from the native born, and certainly the claim that unauthorized immigrants are sort of lawless or lawbreakers. Those are some of the most challenging ones. Oh, and one more I think that we certainly can't overlook is that they are in the United States unauthorized because they didn't get in line or they didn't fill out the proper paperwork. All of those are really tough stereotypes to overcome and very important to overcome.
And we can talk about those, and we should talk about those. Let's go for a moment to this whole question of why people leave their countries in the first place. One of the things that I learned from your book was that it's not people from the poorest countries who are coming to the United States.
That's right. Yeah, I think most of us kind of carry the conception, and it sort of makes practical sense, that the ways that we explain migration, the reasons that people migrate, are because of extreme poverty or maybe political insecurity, warfare in one place. And then sort of unrelated to that, in another place, there is wealth or political security or peace. And so people are pushed by the, let's say, extreme poverty, and then the country with wealth, for example, pulls people. And really, if you look not only at migration to the United States, but if you look globally at migration patterns, what we know about who migrates and why has everything to do with the sort of bridges or linkages or connections that we build with other countries, either through currently the main way that these bridges or linkages are being built is through free trade agreements that encourage other countries to open up their markets and that really have a profound impact on local economies and precipitate, really, in many ways, cause migration as a strategy for survival and certainly as a strategy through which people can kind of get a better standing, not only individuals, but entire communities. And again, this is not just between the United States and other countries, but globally we see this pattern of connections.
Explain more how, let's talk about the U.S. and Mexico, the relationship between free trade agreements between the United States and Mexico and migration.
Okay, yeah. So I of the researchers on the book, I'm the one who's done the most research in Mexico specifically. And, you know, in 1994, we passed a free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And I actually did quite a bit of research in a small community, what's called a rancho, a tiny little town, a village in Mexico, about an hour outside of Mexico City. And this was a place where you could really see the impact of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and also subsidies that are given to U.S. agricultural industries in the United States working together. So again, after NAFTA, people who lived in this small town, first of all, the way that they had subsisted prior to these kind of opening of the local markets to free trade and to foreign investment, they really subsisted on agriculture. They grew corn, and they sold it. Well, corn prices plummeted dramatically in Mexico as a result of partly of subsidization of U.S. based corn producers. And so that became no longer really a strategy, or they didn't have the capacity to subsist. And migration became a necessity for at least one member of every family in this small community. Now, initially, that migration may have been to Mexico City, or it may have been to a what we call an export processing zone, a place where U.S. factories would build facilities. People would go and work in those facilities. Again, that's sort of a first-step migration. And again, the local communities no longer really have an economic base. The economic base they had is really no longer existent. They begin to rely on migrants to send money back to their place of origin. And these export processing zones and the facilities that are built there are fairly notorious for very quick turnover in employees. So when a local economy begins to rely on people who have migrated to work, and let's imagine, for example, that you've been hired to work in a factory that makes jeans and you're getting paid, you know, a dollar, let's say, an hour if you're fortunate, and the jeans are, you know, the jeans are selling across the border in the United States for $50, migration becomes an option. Migration becomes sort of imaginatively a possibility. And then also, of course, real networks and relationships have been built between the United States and these small communities in Mexico. Once the first few people migrate to the United States, those networks begin to be deepened and strengthened to such a degree that really currently we have entire communities that rely on migrants, not only the money they're sending home, but also the jobs that they create in those communities. For example, if they want to build a retirement home in their hometown, there's this deeply kind of intertwined economic, social, and cultural life across borders now that we did not see, you know, prior to this opening to free trade or to the trade agreements.
Well, it's interesting that these trade agreements, on the one hand, open up trade, but at the same time that trade is opening up, the doors to actual migrants are closing. So whereas people could more easily come and live here and stay here and work as a result of U.S. policy, they are forced to do that. Now it's sort of like, as a government here in the United States, we want it both ways. We want to have this free trade, but not have the actual laborers whose lives are affected.
Right. So clearly, I mean, again, what we know, you know, we have plenty of data to show that such agreements create avenues not only for the flow of capital, of money, and of goods, but also of people. Yet, anytime we build one of these agreements, we don't incorporate labor flows into the acceptable flows across national boundaries. And if we were to do that, if the United States and other receiving countries around the world were to do that, it would certainly reflect more accurately our own labor needs in the United States and the outcome, the real outcomes of these sorts of agreements.
We're talking to Marie Friedman Marquardt about the book Living Illegal. So let's talk about the actual kinds of jobs that people are doing here in the United States, migrants from, well, you looked at three countries. You looked at Brazil, Guatemala, and Mexico. And starting off with the question of U.S. population, U.S. population, if it weren't for immigration, would actually be going down. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And certainly, in particular, we have certain population sort of dips, if you look demographically. We have the baby boomers. We have this aging population in the United States. And our population, for example, I mean, it's really remarkable, actually, if you look at the data on this. Our population, for example, of 18 to 24-year-olds who are the U.S.-born 18 to 24-year-olds attending college and university at greater rates than ever before, which takes them out of the workforce. So we already have less 18 to 24-year-olds relative to the aging population, and many of them are out of full-time paid labor. And, of course, they historically have been the sort of strong, strapping people who could do heavy labor. And unauthorized immigrants, if you look at the demographic data on unauthorized immigrants are very young, fit into that, precisely into that demographic. And that's not a coincidence. Again, flows of labor really respond to needs in the United States.
You say, or you actually, you don't say it yourself, but you quote people who are saying something that I often hear, but you never really see it written down because people aren't willing to say it out loud, which is that immigrants are willing to work so much harder than Americans, even working class Americans who would benefit by the kind of upward mobility that these immigrants are engaging in.
Yeah, so we actually did, you know, some of the communities where we focused our research are really considered nationwide among the most sort of stridently anti-immigrant communities. We did research in Cobb County, Georgia, for example, which has two very active anti-immigrant organizations, has been at the forefront of passing legislation that makes life more difficult for unauthorized immigrants and that initiates deportation for many. So we wanted to go into these communities and see really, you know, what on the ground, how do people feel about immigration? What is their experience with unauthorized immigrants that they live and work and worship alongside? And what are their perceptions? And one of the things that was striking is that we did a broad telephone survey of white and African-American residents of these communities. And, you know, an extraordinary majority, more than 75% of both white and African-Americans, said that they believed that Latino unauthorized immigrants were very hardworking, and they did not believe that Latino unauthorized immigrants took jobs from citizens. So they believed that they were filling jobs that citizens wouldn't take. And those kind of perceptions have certainly played out in places like Georgia and Alabama, where we've had this very we've had this legislation passed recently with the intention of making our states very inhospitable for unauthorized immigrants. And the outcome is that unauthorized immigrants are choosing to go elsewhere. So, for example, in Georgia, the spring of 2011, Georgia passed a sort of a statewide immigration bill called HB 87. And shortly after that, before the bill had even been implemented, before the provisions had even been implemented, the growers' associations in South Georgia reported a shortage of 11,000 farm workers. At the time, Georgia had an unemployment rate of almost 10%, yet we could not find native-born workers to fill those jobs, and we still can't. The farm, growers are still saying, we can't fill these jobs. We don't have citizens who want to take these jobs.
I wonder if that is because the people who would be there, the 10% unemployed, are unable to do that kind of work, or whether it's because these American citizens are unwilling to be so completely and thoroughly exploited for almost slave wages.
Yeah, you know, I think this is interesting. I certainly kind of wholeheartedly agree with the concerns about exploitation of unauthorized workers. I mean, one of the most important reasons that we need to fix the problem of having almost 11 million unauthorized workers in the U.S. is because we don't want a population of laborers who are entirely at the mercy of employers and exploitable. I will say, though, I've been, you know, in Georgia and in Alabama, I have had the opportunity to talk with many farm workers and farm growers, and their argument is that this is a type of labor that requires skills, and it requires a capacity to do very hard physical labor. And because it's based on how much you harvest, the unauthorized immigrants who had been working in this for years and were very skilled could earn and did earn, according to the Growers Association in Georgia, between $12 and $20 an hour. Whereas someone who didn't have the skills, who came in and tried to do the labor, of course, wouldn't be able to produce as quickly and would earn much less. So, again, while wanting to affirm that it is deeply problematic to have an unauthorized labor force that can be exploited and is exploited on a regular basis, I also think it's important to acknowledge that the kind of work that unauthorized immigrants are doing, that citizens are not filling these jobs, require certain skills that you develop over time. And these immigrants have worked very hard to develop the skills.
You write in your book that there are some destinations that are not just border cities like El Paso and San Diego and so on that are landing places for immigrants, but there's places that are maybe cities and states that you wouldn't expect where a lot of immigrants are landing from Latin America. What's going on? Where are some of these places and what's happening there?
Yeah, this is probably the biggest story, the biggest thing that we need to pay attention to in terms of immigration patterns in the United States since the early 1990s. It's the phenomenon that we call new destinations. So while rates of migration have remained relatively steady in traditional destinations for immigrants, places like Atlanta, Georgia, Charlotte, North Carolina, have experienced what demographers call hypergrowth. We, for example, Cobb County, where we one of the places where we did research, had a 399% increase in Latino population from 1990 to 2000. I did research in a town, a suburb of Atlanta called Doraville, that went from being 9 to 43% Latino over that period of time. And, you know, this is important because these demographic shifts are happening in areas of the United States, predominantly in the Southeast and also in some Midwestern states that have, particularly those where there's a high concentration of meat processing facilities. These are regions of the country that don't have a history of migration, that don't have a the infrastructure, don't have the organizations in place to assist migrants in their transition. And also in the Southeast, we have a history of very, very problematic race relations, and Latinos are entering into that, into both of those problems. And we find that these new destinations also tend to be, with a couple of exceptions, for example, Arizona would be an exception, but otherwise these new destinations also tend to be the places passing this strident anti-immigrant legislation.
Did you say that Arizona was an exception?
Well, I mean, because Arizona is not a new destination. Arizona has a long history of migration and, of course, is at the forefront of passing this legislation of this sort. But after Arizona, it's the new destinations that really picked up and ran with the type of legislation that was initially crafted in Arizona. So places like Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, other new destinations.
It's interesting. There are some places in your book where you talk about the kind of Latinization of neighborhoods and shopping centers, and there was a barbershop that was an old-time barbershop where they decided to hire a Mexican haircutter in order to open up their clientele. What happened?
Yeah, this is a great story. There's a shopping center, and this is, again, in Cobb County, Georgia. And this barber who had been there for, I think, about 40 years, he had a long history with the community. He cut the hair of the bank owner and the mayor and others. And around him, the neighborhood started to change really remarkably. And all of the shops in this little shopping center by, 2000 were catering specifically to Latino and Asian immigrants and were owned by Latino and Asian immigrants. And he said many of his clients were saying, you should get out of here. What do you, you need to break down shop and go elsewhere. He considered that, but he sort of, and he's this kind of really classic, what we call in the South an old boy, just a really classic old Southern gentleman. And he said, it dawned on me one day, they've got hair, we cut hair, we should be able to make this work. And so instead of leaving, he hired a couple of women to cut hair in the shop who were Mexican, and his shop began to really thrive. And the thing that we saw that I think is so important in that case is that the barbershop became a space where citizens, U.S.-born citizens, and unauthorized immigrants could get to know one another while they're sitting around having their hair cut or talking. And in those spaces, perceptions are really begin to be transformed. I think once people have an opportunity to create a friendship with an unauthorized immigrant, to hear their stories, to understand the choices, the difficult choices that they have to make, and also to recognize what they share in common, perceptions and then also actions really begin to be transformed. So this gentleman who's, kind of a classic, very traditional, very conservative gentleman, had very complex positions that he began to develop on the issue of unauthorized immigration because in his barbershop he had the opportunity to build relationships with immigrants themselves.
But he also lost a significant number of white customers.
He did, yes. And, his white customers, and he joked that for example, he had a white customer for many years who was a bank president, and the white customer said, I'm not coming to your barbershop because, I don't feel comfortable here. You shouldn't be changing this place so much. And then he said, I walked into the branch bank of that particular president's, the branch of his bank, and half the tellers he had hired to speak Spanish. So, he said this is, it's sort of a mixed message and really a mixed perspective. I think this is very telling that in these new destinations, many people have with regard to unauthorized immigrants. When unauthorized immigrants can add to their profitability or can work and are good workers and things along that line, then they're welcome. But when it comes, oftentimes when it comes to kind of opportunities for cultural interaction, schools, and other places, there's really a lot of discrimination.
We're talking to Marie Friedman Marquardt about her book, Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. So we talked at the beginning of the interview about some of the stereotypes that people have about immigrants. For example, they showed up the day before yesterday, they use services, they're taking jobs from Americans, and so on. Let's talk about each of those in a row. The idea that today's immigrants just showed up, that's just obviously and on the face of it not true. What does the real picture look like?
Well, in fact, what we know about our current unauthorized population, it stands at about 10.2 million people currently. And we know that more than half of the unauthorized immigrants currently here have been here for more than 10 years. I think the other sort of telling statistic that I refer to sometimes in reference to this idea is that of those who've been here for more than 10 years, 47% own their own homes. And so I think that statistic really shows that unauthorized immigrants are settling in their local communities. We also have in the United States almost 9 million families that we call mixed-status families. That is, families in which unauthorized immigrants and citizens are living together. And so these households, again, are not transient. They're very much embedded in the lives of our communities, in our schools, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods. And that's very important for us to remember.
And the idea that these folks use more services than other people, is that, there's the amount that you pay in taxes, there's the amount that you get back. Let's talk about both of those in turn.
Well, I think, again, there's a misconception on both ends of this. The first misconception is that unauthorized immigrants don't pay taxes. Unauthorized immigrants pay a range of taxes. Even though, for example, I've mentioned this 47% who own homes of unauthorized immigrants who've been here long term. Of course, they're paying property taxes. Unauthorized immigrants also pay sales taxes and a range of other taxes that others of us pay. And one place where we see a real significant impact in the kind of value of money that unauthorized immigrants are paying in taxes is Social Security. Unauthorized immigrants who are on a payroll pay in, just like we all do, pay in monthly or weekly into Social Security. And, of course, they'll never receive Social Security benefits. So when that money goes in, it goes into what's called a Social Security Reserve Fund. And the Social Security Administration reports that annually $7 to $10 billion are paid into this Social Security Reserve Fund that unauthorized immigrants, of course, will never see the benefits of. And I think this ties into the second misconception we have about unauthorized immigrants. Sometimes we hear that, unauthorized immigrants come to the United States because of the, wonderful social services and welfare services that the United States provides. Well, whether or not the United States provides such services well, our nation certainly does not provide those services to unauthorized immigrants. They are only eligible for two types of benefit. One is elementary education, and the other is emergency health care. There are no other social service benefits that an unauthorized immigrant can receive. So what we know when we look at data that's provided state by state is that states report that unauthorized immigrants pay in more in taxes than they receive in services. And this is largely because they underutilize by comparison to others in their income bracket, they underutilize public services.
I wonder, I mean, when you say that, I'm thinking of people I know who have used the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children. That's not emergency medical care, and they are eligible for that. And also who use clinic services at places like what we have in Santa Fe, a medical clinic called La Familia, which also provides services regardless of your immigration status.
In many cases, for example, WIC is provided by virtue of their children being citizens of the United States, having been born in the United States, in my understanding. And then, of course, there are public clinics. I should be more broad. And there's emergency medical care, emergency rooms that offer emergency, the ones that are designated to offer emergency services to anyone who comes through the doors, also must offer services to unauthorized immigrants. But then there are, of course, agencies that offer services to the broader population that will also offer services to unauthorized immigrants, but they're not guaranteed that possibility. And generally, they're not. Most of those organizations, as far as I know, are not relying on federal funding. They're relying more on private funding, but that might not be the case for the one that you're mentioning.
Let's talk about this whole question of whether immigrants are stealing jobs. I mean, you mentioned that in terms of farm work and some of the piece work that's really heavy duty in the Southeast, and you focus most of your book on locations in the southeastern United States. But what about other areas? I mean, I know personally people who are, for example, carpenters and construction workers who talk about being undercut by laborers from Mexico, from Latin America, who are doing the same kind of work that they are.
Yes, and I do believe, particularly in the construction industry, that, you know, the construction industry during the period from, you know, mid-1990s to mid-2000s, of course, the construction industry was booming, and a lot of work was created in that industry. And as that industry has really shriveled, I mean, certainly, I imagine this is the case in your region of the country, there is increasing competition for work in that industry. And unauthorized immigrants legal immigrants, the immigrants who have a permanent legal residency, in many cases offer services for less money. And so there is competition for those construction-based services. But I will say one of the things that goes along with that concern is that that unauthorized immigrants depress wages for the native-born. And I was just recently at a conference in Alabama, and two economists from the Federal Reserve have just finished a project. They were looking at data on the wage impact of unauthorized immigrants working in the same firm with citizens. What would the wage impact on citizens be? And their research found that the impact was actually fairly negligible. It was about $56 a year across industries. And in industries that relied heavily, for example, service industries, and industries that relied heavily on communication skills, native-born workers, in fact, fared better when they were working in a business that also employed unauthorized immigrants, because they had skills, you know, for example, English language skills, that meant that their pay was actually higher than relative to if they were employed in a company that did not employ unauthorized immigrants. So, again, I think we have to keep in mind that this is linked to the capacity for employers to exploit unauthorized immigrants, but it certainly dispels one of the myths we have about unauthorized immigration.
Now, what about this stereotype that people who come from other countries, particularly Latin American countries, are by and large criminals, criminal element, drug traffickers, drug dealers, meth dealers, all that kind of thing?
Right. Yeah, you know, I think particularly in the border states, I think this is a real concern. Recently, there was an article in the New York Times that talked about how the decline in illegal immigration is linked to decline in crime in border communities. And, you know, I think that the problem with that headline is if you looked a couple lines into the headline and they actually explained the reason for this link, it's not what one might expect on first glance. The reason for this link is that criminals who earn their living by transporting unauthorized immigrants, that is the coyotes or the people who are transport unauthorized immigrants and also in many cases transport drugs, because of the decline in our economy and because there's basically a zero net inflow of immigrants coming across the U.S.-Mexico border right now, they have less unauthorized immigrants to prey on, and their criminal activity has declined significantly. So the immigrants themselves are not the perpetrators of crime. In fact, they're the victims of crime. We, again, in Living Illegal, we heard again and again stories of unauthorized immigrants who were abandoned, exploited, violated, in the case of women, by these coyotes, by these criminals, rings that would transport unauthorized immigrants. What we know if we look nationwide is studies that have been done that look at rates of crime and that compare rates of crime. For example, there's a Harvard sociologist named Robert Sampson, and he's done studies in large cities, in Chicago, for example. And he looked at crime rates, rates of criminality for third generation, that is for citizens who are three generations in, and compared them to rates of crime for unauthorized immigrants. And he found that immigrants have much lower rates of criminality than the third-generation citizens. So while unauthorized immigrants often are targets of crime, they are more often targets of crime than they are perpetrators of crime. And again, I think this is just, it challenges many of the misconceptions we have.
We're talking to Marie Friedman Marquardt about her book, Living Illegal. It also, what you're talking about also brings up another issue, which I think is very important to address, which is that being here illegally, quote unquote, is not actually a crime. Explain the difference between a crime and the kind of violation that not having proper documents is.
That's right. So coming into the United States, crossing a border, whatever border it be, between another country and the United States, and not going through a proper port of entry is an offense that has increased in the penalty. Increasing penalties have been attached to that. But presence in the United States, this sort of unauthorized presence in the United States, is akin to a misdemeanor. It's akin to and I will freely admit that I have sped before. So when I speed, it's akin to that. Immigration law is an administrative law. And while, for example, employing an unauthorized immigrant has much heavier penalties, actually physical presence in the United States is not a crime.
So it's the equivalent of a speeding ticket. And, I mean, I think it's important to note that there are two branches of our judicial system. There's criminal and civil courts, and this is squarely in the area of civil violation.
Yeah, it's administrative law. So I for example, do a lot of work in the largest privately held immigration detention facility, happens to be in Georgia, and I do quite a bit of work there. And of the 2,000 men that are held in that facility, about 10% of them have legal representation. Now, of course, if they were in the criminal system, they would have a right to legal representation and to a public defender. But because they are not in the criminal system, because this is immigration law is administrative law, they have to pay for representation, and only 10% of them actually do get legal representation.
Finally, there is this question of the idea that people who are here illegally just didn't bother to fill out the proper paperwork or to get in line. What is the reality of that?
Yeah, this is so important. We hear again and again our presidential candidates, our hopefuls, even President Obama, they talk about we are a nation of immigrants, we love immigrants, but you need to do it properly. You need to do it the way that my grandparents or parents did it. You need to get in line. And, the Pew Research Center just came out with a study, and actually the editorial board of the Washington Post picked up on this and wrote an editorial on it recently, that of the current unauthorized immigrant population, a significant majority, more than half of the current unauthorized immigrant population has absolutely no line to get into. That is, there is no pathway for them to adjust their status and become permanent residents or even have short-term visas to to live and work inside the United States. And, you know, if they went back to their place of origin, people say, well, why don't they go home and they can get it all lined up and then they can come back the proper way? Well, I can assure you the unauthorized immigrants that I've worked with over the years would do whatever it took. They would pay a penalty, you know, they would take any fines, they would do what it took to go through the process legally, but they simply do not have a pathway for legal presence in the United States. And then beyond that very significant majority who have no line, there's another fairly sizable portion of our unauthorized immigrant population who do in fact have a line, but the line is so long that they simply, for better or worse, have made the decision that waiting is too detrimental for them and their families. And I'll give you an example of this from my research. I can give you many examples of this, but here in Atlanta, we have met many men who are permanent legal residents of the United States. They have a green card. They're legally present here in the United States, and they have a job, and they're working here. Their wife, their spouses, and their minor children, young children, are living, in this case, in Mexico, and they apply on behalf of their spouse and minor children so that the family can be reunited and live together where the father works. During most of the 1990s and first part of the 2000s, when we were doing this research, the wait time for that spouse and those young children to reunite with their husband/father ranged around 10 to 12 years. So there were many cases in which, again, whether or not this was the right decision, I can't say, but I can say that I think for families to be expected to be separated for that period of time, when the father, in this case, is a permanent legal resident, is an extraordinary burden on these families. And there were many cases in which the spouse and children came to the United States without authorization and then joined our unauthorized population. Since 2001, there's been a significant penalty placed on the people who have made this decision. And when they do get to the front of the line, they will have a 10-year bar on reentry. They will have to return to their place of origin, wait 10 years, and then begin the process. So certainly the decision has had very, very significant and difficult impact on these families.
The kinds of rules you're talking about, which are absurd in the sense of, I mean, if people believe in families being able to be together and mothers and fathers and children and so on, they bespeak a politics of not only anti-immigration, but which, again, is crazy because we are, as you say and as everybody says, a nation of almost, you know, primarily immigrants, but it bespeaks a politics of fear. What are anti-immigrant voters afraid of, and how are these fears stoked by politicians?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think, again, when we look at the places where this anti-immigrant sentiment has been able to sort of take root and flourish, these are often communities that have experienced remarkable demographic change over short periods of time. And there is a fear of difference. There's a fear of hearing another language spoken. There's a fear of people who are ethnically different, culturally different, and otherwise. But again, one of the things that we really found in the book and tried to bring out and tried to kind of make sense of is that when there is an opportunity for safe face-to-face encounter between immigrants and native-born, these fears dissolve very quickly. And in place of these fears emerge kind of relationships. And from those relationships, these local communities, certainly not at the federal level right now, but local communities are actually finding ways to create real solutions to the problems that their communities face as a result of extraordinary growth and also of diversification over a very short period of time. So I certainly think that is a key fear that plays into this this problem.
In your view, what do the anti-immigrant politicians get out of stoking these fears, which, as you say, kind of dissolve once people get to know each other? But what do they get out of it on a political level?
Yeah, you know, that question reminds me of a meeting that we had kind of early on in our research in Cobb County, which again is this county that has experienced such extraordinary growth, and at the same time, extraordinary ethnic diversification. And we are meeting with one of the county commissioners, and he said, you know, to be honest, so many of the problems that we hear, and this was a very conservative politician, by the way, he said, yeah, I've got to be honest with you, so many of the problems that we hear attributed to immigrants, and then specifically to unauthorized immigrants, are not problems of immigration. They're problems of migration. They're problems of the remarkable growth that our communities have undergone, so overcrowded schools, traffic, other problems. But, of course, unauthorized immigrants are, in a sense, a very easy target because they don't have any political capital. They don't have political power. Many of them are, with the exception, I would argue, of the young adults, many of them are really afraid to speak out and to say they're not participating. And also, I think they are more engaged in media outlets that are not the mainstream media outlets. So it's easy to point a finger at someone who is doesn't bear political power, the sort of political capital, to speak back to you. And I think that oftentimes that's what happens.
What is the Secure Communities Program, and how widespread is it?
The Secure Communities Program is part of a larger initiative under the Obama administration of the Department of Homeland Security, which is to move more toward experimenting with what's oftentimes called the local enforcement model. And the idea of Secure Communities is for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the federal agency, to partner with local law enforcement agencies, and in such a way that anyone who is brought into a local law enforcement agency in communities that have partnered with ICE will be fingerprinted, and that those fingerprints will be run not only against an FBI database but also against an immigration database. And so the intention of Secure Community, and the Obama administration is a very strong advocate of Secure Communities. They in fact, intend to have it rolled out across the United States. I believe now the target date is by the end of 2013. And the stated intention of Secure Communities is to target criminal illegal immigrants or unauthorized immigrants for detention and deportation. But what we see again and again in many of the local law enforcement agencies that have agreed to come on board with Secure Communities is that, you know, they after having implemented it and kind of lived with this program for a few months or a year or a couple of years, they're actually going back to the administration, many of them, and saying, this is not what we intended, and we'd like to not participate in Secure Communities. And the administration is saying, no, it's now a requirement. And the reason that these local agencies are not enthusiastic about the program or as enthusiastic as they had been initially is, first of all, because this fingerprinting happens at the moment of arrest and not at the moment of conviction, we hear cases again and again, for example, of let's say a woman who's a victim of domestic violence. Well, when one makes a domestic violence call, both the alleged perpetrator and the victim, in many cases, are fingerprinted. This victim of domestic violence enters into the system. And, for example, if she has had a prior deportation, she comes up in the system and all of a sudden is entering into our detention and deportation system. Or we have cases, again and again, cases of a mother of three citizen children who's driving and put on her blinker, or forgot to put on her blinker when she was turning, got pulled over by a local law enforcement agent, and finds herself suddenly in detention and deportation because she has, for example, an expired visa. So what local law enforcement is saying is, first of all, this isn't targeting the people that we want to target. This isn't doing the work that we expected it to do. Secondly, we're having to divert the resources of our local law enforcement to become immigration enforcement officers, which is keeping us from actually pursuing criminals in our communities and is making our communities, in fact, less safe. And thirdly, in another way that this really has had a negative impact on the safety of local communities is when you have a significant proportion of the population of your communities who fear law enforcement. So they're kind of living their everyday lives. Something happens, let's say they're a victim of crime, they're afraid to go to local law enforcement because they know of so many people who have gotten caught up in this system and entered into deportation. The local law enforcement agents can't do their job. So there's a fantastic PBS documentary, Frontline documentary on this called Lost in Detention that looks at one Illinois local sheriff who, again, at the outset of Secure Communities said, I'm on board with this 100%. This sounds fantastic. And as he watched the program unfold and the impact it had on his local community, he had a real kind of 180-degree turnaround, but, again, is now required by the federal government to continue to participate.
Is everybody required to participate, or who's in and who's out of that program?
Well, it is unfolding slowly throughout the nation. So it depends on what part of the country you're in. Currently, not everyone is participating. But again, the intention of the administration is to have full participation by the end of 2013, the last time that I checked the way that they're unfolding this. So, for example, in my community in Metro Atlanta, we have four counties that participate in Secure Communities, and we will increase that number as each year goes by.
And meanwhile, you have people like some of the ones who are described in your book, where, let's say, a high school or a college student was brought here by her parents at the age of 2 and doesn't have proper documentation but went through high school, is going through college, suddenly gets a parking ticket or a traffic ticket or something and is in immigration detention prison without a lawyer for a month or more at a time and suddenly deported to a country she doesn't know at all.
Yeah, that's right. And that there's another program that's very similar to Secure Communities. It's called the 287G program. And the difference with 287Gs is that in counties that have this agreement, this sort of agreement with ICE, with the federal agency, they can, for example, set up a roadblock, and this happens often in the counties in my region that participate in 287Gs, set up a roadblock and simply check for driver's licenses for anyone who's coming through the roadblock. And, of course, in all but three states, your state being one of those three, in all but three states in the United States, unauthorized immigrants can't obtain a driver's license. So these roadblocks really become simple immigration checkpoints, although they technically are not allowed to be that. that's what they become. And we have, you know, for example, in Cobb County, this county where we did research, in their first year of participation in this program called 287G, they initiated deportation for 3,000 Cobb County residents, unauthorized immigrants who are living in Cobb County or at least driving through Cobb County. And of those 3,000, 69% were detained for a minor traffic violation. So these are, you know, again, driving without a license, making an improper turn. The young woman that you mentioned was detained for improper maneuvering in the parking lot of her college. And it's, you know, behind each of these numbers is a family, is a family that's torn asunder by these policies. And I think in particular, when you think about the resources that we as taxpayers are putting into detaining and deporting unauthorized immigrants who've been here for 15 years, are waiting and hoping for a chance to adjust their status, are trying their best to live according to the laws of the nation. And I say that unapologetically. Many, many, the overwhelming majority of unauthorized immigrants that we've had the opportunity to get to know and encounter are doing everything they can to live according to the laws of the nation. And then something like this happens, and it's all over. And this is particularly devastating and just so hard to have watched for the unauthorized immigrants who were brought to the United States as children. We have 65,000 unauthorized immigrants graduate from U.S. high schools a year. Somewhere around 2.5 million unauthorized of our unauthorized immigrants were brought here as children. and they have no way to adjust their status, and they're facing dead ends, and now they're also facing deportation to a country that most of them have never visited, where a language is spoken that most of them may speak, but probably don't read and write too much because they came up through our school systems.
Marie Friedman Marquardt is co-author of the book Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. Marie is scholar in residence at Emory University's Candler School of Theology in Atlanta, Georgia. And there's so much more to talk about the church and to talk about some of the things that these communities are doing, but people will just have to read the book. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me, Mary Charlotte.